this time on your weekly constitutional.
One of the headlines that the Brexiteers used in their successful campaign was "Take Back Control." The three words that resonated very, very loudly. And that essentially means control of our borders.
That was Tony Story, a law professor from the University of Northumbria in England, talking about, of course, Brexit. With him was William Walton, who's been on the show several times before.
The view I take is whether it's good law or bad law, not whether it's from the European Union or from Westminster. And then there are other people who take the view that it doesn't really matter whether it's good law or bad law. The point is, it's not our law.
Brexit is a major constitutional issue, and today, it's what we're going to be talking about. At your weekly constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris, and the British are here again.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Most professors of American constitutional law are, well, American. William Walton is the exception. He's from Britain, and if you're a longtime listener, you've heard him several times before on the show because, you see, Bill brings his students over every year or two, and they do all sorts of interesting things, constitutional tours, if you will. This year is no different. He brought a bunch of students, and I recorded some interviews with them out at Montpelier because they made that a stop on their tour. We'll hear from the students in a later episode. Today, we're going to hear from Bill and a colleague of his. His name is Tony Story. And he knows all about European Union law. And so, guess what? It's another episode on the continuing saga of Brexit.
My name is William Walton, and I'm a professor of law at Northumbria University in Newcastle upon Tyne, and I teach law, particularly American constitutional law.
Making either your fifth or sixth appearance on the show, depending on how one counts them
up. Like that. Yeah,
but you have
like
a colleague
that.
With you here today. Who's this fellow?
Hi, I'm Tony Story. I'm also a professor of law at Northumbria. I teach European Union law, despite the Brexit referendum. I teach English criminal law and also sports law.
Very interesting. Well, you mentioned the B word, Tony. You mentioned Brexit.
Yep.
So is European Union law still relevant in Britain?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, well, tell us about that. What's going on with Brexit?
Well, currently, the United Kingdom is scheduled to leave on 31st of March 2019. So the clock is ticking down, less than a year to go now. The British government has introduced legislation into the UK Parliament. This is the European Union Withdrawal Bill. And assuming that passes, then the UK will leave in March of next year. Meanwhile, British government have negotiators in Brussels trying to negotiate what happens next.
When you say leave,
yes.
I realize there are different definitions
Absolutely.
Of leave.
Sure.
What definition are we using here when we talk about March of 2019? If things go according to that particular plan, what does that actually mean will happen then?
Well, the government position is what people might know of as a hard Brexit. So according to the Prime Minister, we are leaving the European Union, we are leaving the single market, we are leaving the customs union, everything. That's the hard Brexit position. Now, whether that actually happens or not is a very moot point at the moment. My understanding is that the Labour Party, the official opposition, would prefer a softer Brexit. Now, soft Brexit comes in various options, and there are other European states which have connections to the European Union without being members of it. So there is a so-called Norwegian option, there is a so-called Swiss option. Those are options on the table.
And what are those?
Well, Norway and Switzerland are both members of the European Free Trade Association, which the United Kingdom helped to found back in 1960, although we subsequently left it when we joined the European Economic Community, which subsequently became the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
But Norway and Switzerland are both members of that, and Norway is also a member of what's called the European Economic Area. What that does, it gives Norway access to the single market and the customs union. Switzerland is a member of the European Free Trade Association, but not a member of the single market or the customs union. Instead, Switzerland has a number of bilateral agreements with the European Union on a whole range of different topic areas.
And so all of these options are on the table.
These are
now.
Absolutely options on the table.
And that's one of the things that makes you so uncertain as to what's going to happen in
absolutely.
A year.
Absolutely. Nobody knows. Literally nobody knows. What the Prime Minister has said, this was maybe 6 months ago, is that the United Kingdom is hoping to negotiate a bespoke, unique deal, primarily focusing on trade at the moment, but potentially including other things, with the EU, which would be different from the Norwegian and Swiss options. So we'd have a UK option.
Now, the reports I've been reading on this side of the Atlantic Ocean suggest that your government has not done too well in its negotiations up to this point,
sure.
and that mostly it's been the EU dictating terms.
Yeah. Yeah.
Has that been your perception
that
as well?
That's my perception, yes. Although it depends which newspapers you read, but I think the truth is what you've just said there, that the EU's winning the negotiation so far.
So Britain might not be happy with the deal that it ultimately gets.
Quite true, yes. Certainly the right-wing populist newspapers will be very unhappy. I think they would want a hard Brexit.
Bill, you've been making some notes over
here.
What are your thoughts on this process?
Tony's absolutely right that we leave formally on the 30th or 31st of March of next year. It's actually more specific than that. It's 11 p.m., isn't it?
Yeah, there's a time specified.
So that we're in line with European time. Then what has been agreed very recently, and this was only 2 or 3 weeks ago, is that there would be a transition period after that of 18 months.
Yep.
There was talk of a transition period of 2 years originally. They've now brought that back to 18 months. So I think we would then be out by
2021.
Something like late 2021. Just on the negotiations, the first phase of negotiations, I'm not sure if that's still going on, but there were three issues that they were discussing. I think they must be going on because they haven't really resolved it yet. And those three issues were the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland, which is a real stumbling block for those advocating
Because the
Brexit.
Republic of Ireland would stay in the EU.
That's correct.
But Northern Ireland would Brexit along with the rest of the UK.
That's correct. That's correct.
And
correct.
So that now becomes an international border.
Correct.
That's correct.
Well,
and
it is an international border already, but then it would become an EU, non-EU border.
Yeah, right.
Then there are issues about, again, to use this metaphor, hard and soft, a hard border and a soft border. And, of course, the desire by all parties concerned to avoid what they see as a hard border, which would be a return to border checks and all of the associations that would have with the grim past of Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I've been hearing things have been sort of going downward in that area anyway, the relations between the various parties in Northern Ireland.
Well, you were asking earlier on the students about devolution when we were chatting to you in the other room. And
right.
As Tony was saying to myself, Northern Ireland has a devolved administration, but that hasn't been abandoned altogether, but that fell into abeyance about 18 months ago following a dispute, believe it or not, over heating scheme, monies for a heating scheme. And the consequence of that is that the Sinn Féin pulled the plug and walked out, and the consequence of that is that the administration, the devolved administration, which is the Northern Ireland Assembly, I beg your pardon, was suspended and is still not sitting.
So the situation's not very good up there right now anyway, and now we're going to have perhaps a hard border there, which will maybe harden feelings. That's the fear anyway.
And the second issue is immigration, as to what happens to EU citizens living in Britain. What are their rights and entitlements following Brexit? Will they be given UK citizenship automatically? Will they have to reapply? And also what happens to UK citizens who have moved to the EU? So, for example, you were speaking to, for another of your programs, you were speaking to Panos earlier on.
Right, from Cyprus.
From Cyprus.
An EU citizen.
He's an EU citizen, but a lot of Brits, if I can call it that, living, who have retired to Cyprus, and they're EU citizens. But what will happen to their citizenship following Brexit? And then the third issue was debt, the money. What are the, when you disentangle, when you split countries up, what happens to the assets? So the British government says, well, we've contributed to the construction of the European Parliament, for example. Do we have to continue paying for the pensions of European civil servants? And the general view is that we should honour our obligations. And I think the other thing to say is, and Tony can help me here, is that because this has never really happened before in the European Union, this is complete terra incognita. Nobody really knows what the rules are in terms of divorce, disentanglement. Right. So this issue of assets, who will pay for that? That's probably of the three issues there. That's probably the least contentious. But Northern Ireland and Northern Ireland is particularly contentious. And there's a view that you can't really start to resolve the Northern Ireland issue until you look at the trade issue, mm-hmm. because the two are inextricably linked. Yeah. Because there's talk about, for example, whether you could have, depending upon, as Tony said, depending upon whether we remain part of the tariffs or the customs union, whether there would be border checks or whether these things would be actually done at the company. So if a company making fridges in Ireland could perhaps undertake these tariff checks on their plant, on their site in Dublin, and they wouldn't need to stop the vehicle at the border. It would all be done beforehand. So these issues they seem to be a long way from being resolved. And it's very difficult to know, because what you hear is bits and pieces. We have three people involved in negotiation that I'm aware of: David Davis, Liam Fox and Boris Johnson. It's David Davis who is the lead negotiator. And there are occasional reports to Parliament, but the government made it pretty clear from the start that they would not be giving a running commentary on day-to-day negotiations, which makes a position for people like ourselves as voters more difficult to know, and to trust the politicians as to what's going on. We don't know.
I know that Theresa May has insisted time and again that Brexit's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
People have spoken, and she's not going to question that.
Yep.
But I also know that there are other people who have suggested that a parliamentary vote, mm-hmm. A second bite of the apple, perhaps, that might allow a reversal of this decision, that's something that should happen.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I've been hearing that there have been revelations about fake news and manipulation through social media that was part of the Brexit campaign. Is that a serious enough issue that politicians in Britain might say that there somehow taints Brexit and that there should be another referendum?
Is this an oblique reference to the Cambridge?
I think it's come out of that whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, we all
the Facebook
have, we here in this country are still trying to assess exactly how much we were manipulated by whomever, mm-hmm. whether it was Russia or somebody else in our 2016 elections.
Yeah.
And of course, that was the same year that Brexit occurred. And so I've been hearing similar allegations that there was similar manipulation or similar misinformation that was being fed, especially to those who ultimately voted in favor of Brexit. Is that not as serious as I've been hearing, or is that a serious issue now that's being investigated the same way we're investigating our electoral issues here?
Well, I think the issue of misinformation goes back at least 2 years to the launch of the referendum itself, which was declared, if I remember rightly, in about February of 2016. And that then preceded a four-month period of time during which the Vote Leave campaign and the Remain campaign were able to set out their stall. And the Vote Leave campaign, in particular, I think, have been accused, and I think rightly to some extent anyway, of deliberately misleading the public. There was this famous battle bus. You may have seen images of it. Big red bus that drove around the country emblazoned with a slogan saying, "We give £350 million a week to the EU. Let's give that to the National Health Service instead." Now, I think everybody now knows anyway that that figure was grossly inflated. And even Nigel Farage, the then leader of the UK Independence Party, UKIP, admitted, I think the day when the referendum result came in, that slogan was not true and should never have been used. So there was a schism in the Vote Leave camp even about that. But I mean, it obviously had an effect. I mean, that bus was highly visible. It literally drove around the country. News camera crews followed it everywhere. It was everywhere. I also read somewhere, I don't know whether this is absolutely true or not, so maybe your listeners could try and check this out for yourself, but I read that in the British print media in the 3 or 4 months running up to the referendum, that something like 80% of the print media was pro-Brexit, leaving only 20% that was pro-Remain. Social media, very different, but the print media, very much in favour of Leave. And some of those newspapers have definitely been creative with the truth, shall we say, over the years. Not necessarily outright lying, but have certainly exaggerated and inflated issues.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm having a delightful conversation with an old friend, William Walton, and a new friend, Tony Story. They're both law professors at the University of Northumbria in England, and we're talking all about, well, British law. After the break, we'll talk some more with Bill and Tony. Stick around. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue our discussion with William Walton and Tony Story, two law professors from the University of Northumbria. And we're talking about a variety of British constitutional issues today, but mostly about Brexit, which, of course, is essentially a secession of Britain from the European Union. Long-standing issue. We've talked about it several times before, but the story just keeps on coming. And so this is, in some sense, an update of what we've said before. Just before the break, we were talking about the fact that the Brexit debate itself may have been infected, just as our 2016 elections were infected, by foreign influence, perhaps from Russia. And so we're going to pick up the story there.
We've been hearing a lot about the former Russian spies who were poisoned with a nerve agent in Britain, and how this has prompted quite a reaction within Britain, within the EU, and ultimately, somewhat belatedly, within the United States. And of course, it's the Russians. And the Russians seem to be the country that has the most to gain from a breakup of the European Union. Yep. It certainly would have a lot to gain to the extent that NATO becomes less stable. Is there any sense on your part that Russia's bad boy behavior over the last couple of years is having an effect, is moving people away from their Brexit sentiments or not?
Oh, goodness. I was going to say pass, but on the Salisbury attacks, that's where it happened, the town in Wiltshire, the famous cathedral town, there are still some question marks over the use of this nerve agent. As to the two individuals, certainly the daughter, I think, has recovered now. And we're told that her father is, a week ago when I left, was sitting up in bed and answering questions, or in a better state anyway. There's an issue about the poison, the nerve agent having been found on the door handle of their home. And there seem to be a series of unanswered questions. I'm not trying to suggest that there's been some conspiracy, but the extent of Russian involvement or the nature of Russian involvement, if the Russians were involved, is still to be determined. And there are people in British radio who would go further than that and say it's actually it's a British conspiracy to implicate Russia. Now, I'm not necessarily subscribing to that, but I do, from what I and I'm. Probably like Tony here, I'm dependent really upon what I read in the press. But again, it's one of these issues which perhaps we're not that well informed about. But there do seem to be a series of questions which haven't been answered that, you know, are almost obvious to ask. Why is it that if this nerve agent is so effective, why is it that these two people did not die? Of course, we don't want that to happen, but there are questions that remain unanswered, but perhaps by the time we get back, there'll be more known.
Well, the reason I'm asking you, of course, is because, as you know, NATO was formed in 1949, and it was formed in response to what was perceived as an aggressive Soviet Union. And so, to some extent, the Cold War was a unifying force across the Atlantic and, of course, across Western Europe. And no doubt, that Soviet threat was part of the motivation for putting together this international order, which now seems to be coming apart at the seams. And so I guess my question was, is there any sense on your part that any of that sentiment is changing now that Russia seems to be acting more aggressively, now that there seems to be more coming out about Russian interference, certainly in our elections and maybe in the Brexit vote as well? But neither one of you seems to think that the sentiment's changing. So
I think it's probably too early to tell whether the poisoning of the Skripals has actually changed public perceptions. I mean, we hear on more or less a weekly basis that a survey has been done of a certain proportion of the electorate, and sometimes the survey will say if there was another referendum now, then it would be a Remain vote. But other surveys say it would be more or less exactly the same as the original Brexit referendum result 2 years ago.
Okay. Well, looks then the conclusion, at least for the moment, is that Brexit is coming and Brexit is going to happen.
Yep.
I don't sense that either of you is particularly happy about that.
That's true.
Well, tell me why. Why is Brexit such a bad idea?
Well, I mean, I'm a scholar and researcher and tutor in European Union law going back, well, more years than I care to remember. Effectively, my entire adult life, I've been either learning about it or reading about it or teaching the subject. And I would concede it's not a perfect construct, the European Union. I actually did a survey. This was a fortnight before the referendum. There was a website I was on, and it said you can do a self-test to see how pro-European you were. And I was 91% pro-European, mm-hmm. So not 100%, but still, you know, pretty high. So I concede it's not perfect, but I think the advantages massively outweigh the disadvantages.
Just remind Americans who might not really be familiar with that, what are the major advantages of the EU?
Well, strength in numbers is, I think, you know, the headline. So the idea that now 28 independent countries have formed a union, falling short of a federation, but nevertheless a union within which there are legal standards that apply equally. It facilitates the free trade. It facilitates the free movement of people, which I think is something to be celebrated. People who may live in a low-wage part of the union can travel to higher wage, or where there's skills shortages, employers can plug skills gaps by recruiting workers from other EU member states. There's free movement of services, which is massively important to the United Kingdom. Obviously, they've got the City of London,
financial
institutions, banking institutions, legal institutions, all based there. Multinational, lots of American companies are based in London. What are they going to be doing in a year's time? There's a lot of talk about these institutions, whether they're financial, insurance companies, banks, law firms, possibly going to Dublin, possibly going to Paris, possibly going to Frankfurt. That's a big concern. And they're in London in the first place, I think, most of these multinational companies, because they have access to half a billion consumers across the entire European Union. But it's not just about free trade and free movement of people. There are rules to protect the environment. There are rules to protect
consumers,
workers' rights. There are rules to protect consumer rights. The list is not endless, but it's a very long list. So
lots of advantages. So what are the disadvantages? Okay. What are the Brexiteers?
Well,
why do they hate it so much?
Well, the Brexiteers regard it as an enormous, inefficient, bureaucratic monster that imposes rules, unnecessary rules, the Brexiteers would say, red tape writ large, on independent states that are simply unnecessary, and that a country like the United Kingdom, with a long, hundreds of years of history of international trade and exploration and so on, would be better off freed from the tentacles of the European Union machine. One of the headlines that the Brexiteers used in their successful campaign was "Take Back Control," the three words that resonated very, very loudly. And that essentially means control of our borders. I say our borders, the United Kingdom's borders. And I think it often boils down to whether you regarded immigration as an opportunity to be celebrated or a threat to be resisted. And I think the Remain vote, and it is worth pointing out, somewhere in the region of 16 million people did vote to Remain. And I think, by and large, people who voted Remain tended to be the younger voters who regarded the movement of people as an opportunity, something to be welcomed, something to be encouraged. Whereas the 17 or so million people who voted to leave, this is a bit of a generalization, but older voters who maybe regarded immigration as a threat, or at least a potential threat anyway, and therefore to be controlled to a greater extent than it already is, and hence that take back control.
Does it just boil down to xenophobia then?
No, absolutely not. But I mean, that I think was a key component. Mm-hmm. And without that, I think the vote may well have gone the other way. But that big red bus that I mentioned earlier on, mm-hmm. with the £350 million on it, and the take back control slogan, those two factors were very significant, underpinned, as I say, by the fairly blatant pro-Brexit populist press.
But there was also an issue about sovereignty. I've on the program that James and I were on a couple of years ago. There's this issue of take back control that has also been synonymous with sovereignty or regaining sovereignty. So, of course, the European Union, like your federal government, has democratic institutions. It has a legislature, it has a judiciary, it has an executive. And there's sometimes a feeling, or it's very often the feeling, that much of our legislation, as we've said to you before in this program, and as Tony has just intimated, with consumer rights and product rights and environmental rights and so on, much of our legislation is very heavily informed by the European Union through directives and through European regulations. Now, I've said to you before, I think that the view I take is whether it's good law or bad law, not whether it's from the European Union or from Westminster. And I think a lot of European Union law is good law, but a lot of on the political right believe, first of all, that a lot of it is red tape regulatory law. And then there are other people who take the view that it doesn't really matter whether it's good law or bad law. The point is it's not our law.
That's the straightforward sovereignty argument.
But there is also, I think, again, to echo some of the sentiments being expressed earlier, there's a lot of ignorance here. So, for example, people conflate the European Court of Human Rights with the European Court. Now, the two are entirely separate, and the European Convention on Human Rights is something that the United Kingdom has no intention, as I understand it, of removing itself from. But if you ask people on the street, one of the first things they'll say about the European Union is, oh, it's the European courts that prevent us from deporting people who advocate terrorism because they claim that they have human rights. And to which you have to say, well, that's actually nothing to do with the European Union. That's the European Court of Human Rights, which is a similar name, but it is actually a different legal institution. And Britain, ironically, was one of the original authors of the European Court of Convention on Human Rights. And I think I sent you that rather amusing little video.
One of the great ironies in all of this, whether it's Brexit for you or whether it's a lot of the stuff that's happening in the United States right now with our seeming to be withdrawing from so many different international associations and trade agreements, is that this was the international order that Britain and the United States together created after the end of World War II. I mean, we were the primary authors of the post-war international order, economic and political and military. And now it is we who are actively tearing it down. And I spent most of my life during the Cold War era. That's when I was in the military. I was part of an organization that was trying to support this international order, and it's really sort of disconcerting to see it coming apart because we ourselves are deciding to tear it down. Do you share that opinion?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's the great irony here, is that people are saying that we're being dictated to by these institutions, but we're the ones who created them. Probably the greatest analogy in this country is to the United Nations. It sort of surprised me as an adult to realize how many people were so adamantly opposed to the United Nations and how many conspiracy theories there were about blue-helmeted soldiers who were going to invade us. I remember once I knew a gentleman who was absolutely a believer in all of that, and he would show me all these satellite images on the internet that would always turn out to be something entirely benign, but they were evidence of the gathering of UN troops within our borders. And at one point, I looked at him and I said, John, we created the United Nations. And yes, we fund a significant portion of it, but that gives us a significant amount of control as well. And we sit on a Security Council that has a veto power over any significant action that that organization is going to take. So we created this. So why are you now suspicious of our own creation? And I've never really gotten a satisfactory answer to that question. And it seems to be that's what's happening in your country as well.
I think I may well be right. It reminds me of the British government's position prior to the Brexit referendum, when David Cameron was the Prime Minister, which was that we should remain in the European Union. It was supported by his then Home Secretary, Theresa May, on that point, interestingly enough. Anyway, their position was that we should remain in the European Union but seek to reform it. Because obviously Britain had never been an original member state, but joined in 1973. And it's true that when the European Economic Community was founded in the 1950s, it was primarily about free trade and movement of working people. And it certainly expanded significantly over that time period. And maybe it has gotten too big. I mean, as I was saying earlier on, I'm a big fan of the European Union, but I do concede it's not perfect. So I think there was definitely scope for it to be reformed and maybe streamlined. I still hold that view. But the United Kingdom would have been, in my personal opinion, better off staying in and helping to reform the institution rather than leaving it. We shall see.
All right, we guess we shall see. Well, what other issues have we not covered, either Brexit or other than Brexit?
Well, there's the May government, but it seems to be... Are we on at the moment?
Sure.
There's the May government, but it seems to be struggling on. So when I spoke to you, I'm sending you emails, obviously, over the last few months, and following the election of last year, when, if you remember, Theresa May secured a minority administration, so not an outright majority. And therefore she's had to form an alliance with the DUP, the Democrat Unionist Party from Northern Ireland. I think there was a belief at that stage, from many political analysis, that Theresa May might only last a matter of months. And, OK, it's only 10, 11 months later, but she is still there. And I don't think there's any appetite within the Conservative Party to dislodge her at the moment because, first of all, who would replace her? There's that issue. And secondly, it would be difficult, as I said to you previously, for to dislodge her and then have the next Prime Minister chosen yet again by a constituency of 320 or so Conservative MPs, as I think there would be an appetite or a belief that really the right thing to do would be to go back to the country and have another general election. And I think there's still a fear in the Conservative Party, and Tony can speak to this as an enthusiastic supporter of Jeremy Corbyn, that Corbyn could, you know, could win. If there were an election call tomorrow, Corbyn could win. And that's a genuine fear for the Conservatives, that a year ago they felt that they were unassailable. They felt that they were that they would absolutely destroy Labour in the June 2016 election, and that didn't happen. They did win. You know, they got more votes and more seats than Labour. But Labour did extremely well, far better than expected, and Corbyn was a far more effective candidate than many people expected. And resonated, I think, particularly with young people. He went out on the streets and he held rallies at which thousands or tens of thousands of people attended. Theresa May went on a battle bus to private airfields such as in Northumberland, and she would speak to 35 journalists. Mm-hmm. And she'd be snuck in and snuck out.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's a Brexit update. Brexit is perhaps the most significant issue in British constitutional law these days. And I'm fortunate enough to have two British law professors with me from the University of Northumbria. They are William Walton and Tony Story. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with William Walton and Tony Story, two law professors from the University of Northumbria in England. We've been talking primarily about Brexit, but also about the political fallout from it. And it turns out that quite recently, Theresa May, the Prime Minister over there, lost her parliamentary majority and is governing from a position of minority, that is, significantly reduced strength. And this gives an opening to the Labour Party and its leader, Jeremy Corbyn.
Corbyn has been compared to our Bernie Sanders.
He has, and it's a rather obvious parallel to make, and I can see why people make it. He's an elderly gentleman who's been around politics for an awful long time, but he's been very consistent on a number of issues. That is a difficulty for him now, because of course he's been passionately opposed to Britain's membership of the European Union, and he's now leading a party which includes. It gains a lot of support from people who are pro-membership of the European Union. So in the last election of June of last year, 2017, where are we now, 2018? 2017. In the election of last year, both of the major parties wanted to respect the outcome of the referendum.
Yes, that's right.
And that's the word, that's the expression that Labour use. And that meant that the two major parties garnered the support of about 80%, 90% of the electorate in England and Wales, certainly. So 80 or 90% of the electorate, irrespective of where they voted on Brexit, voted for parties that were broadly in favour of Brexit. Now, Labour, it's a sort of more nuanced transition now. It's going through a phase of trying to reposition itself to perhaps, I mean, both parties say we want some sort of bespoke deal with, as Tony said, with the customs union and with the single market. Mm-hmm. Whether Labour will go, I mean, they're not going to go back to say we want to remain a member of the European Union. I don't think so. But maybe their version of a bespoke deal would be perhaps more like what we left than the Conservatives' version of a bespoke deal. And I've said this to you before, the difficulty for the British political parties is that the European Union, the captains of the European Union, are very concerned, I think, about contagion. We've discussed that before, that if Britain gets a very good deal, is allowed to leave the European Union but retains these four, and retains three of the fundamental freedoms, a free movement of capital, goods and services, but not free movement of labour, but retains all of the other benefits, well, maybe Holland will say, do you know what, we'll follow Britain.
Right.
You know, we'll negotiate a similar deal.
The EU can't give you too good a deal. I can understand that.
That's exactly it.
Right.
If the EU gives us too good a deal, there would be other countries perhaps who would say, do you know what, we'll do the same.
The bill suggested that you are a Labourite, Tony.
This is true. Yes.
Uh-huh. So
yes,
you're a Jeremy Corbyn supporter.
Yeah. Corbynista, I think is the
Corbynista.
Expression. Yeah.
Now, I've been seeing, correct me if I'm wrong, have there been some allegations of anti-Semitism?
Yeah. There have been numerous allegations.
What's the story with that?
Ooh, I'm not really too confident on speaking about that one, to be honest. I mean, the Labour Party as a whole has been accused of anti-Semitism. And I think it's what the media are saying is that at the very least Corbyn should have done more to distance himself and or the party from anti-Semitic factions within Labour.
Mm-hmm. Many people in the Labour Party have always given support to a separate Palestine, a Palestinian independence, mm-hmm. a separate state. And some people outside conflate this with a form of opposed to Zionism or anti-Semitism as being.
Okay, so this is wrapped up in the Palestinian-Israeli debate.
I think in large part, I've heard from one of our colleagues, who obviously won't mention that person's name, but his or her view was that within the Labour Party, and this person is close to the Labour Party, within the Labour Party, there is some anti-Semitism. I don't know. It's not something my days of membership of the Labour Party are many, many years behind me, although I'm, still a voter for Labour. But I was never aware until recently that there were such accusations or allegations of anti-Semitism. So it has come out of, it's been very recent. And there was a report conducted by Shami Chakrabarty, the human rights, Lord Chakrabarty, human rights lawyer on behalf of Labour into the Labour's position on anti-Semitism within the Labour Party. And I think it gave the Labour Party broadly a clean bill of health, subject to one or two qualifications. And I think this is something, going back to what we said earlier on about the media, this is something which the right-wing press want to exaggerate or certainly want to inflate. So how much substance there is to this and how much is actually what one might call media hype, I don't know. But it certainly has been, as you said, it's certainly been a prominent issue in the press over the last two or three weeks.
Well, we've had an issue more broadly, and it's typically associated with the political right in this country rather than the political left. But a resurgence in rather authoritarian expressions. We had the Nazis and the white supremacists who were marching right down the road here in Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. Some of them rather flagrantly, referencing Nazism, and that has been coming to the fore in this country rather disturbingly over the last couple of years. And so what I was asking, I think, generally, is that also a phenomenon in Britain these days, whether it's within the Labour Party or elsewhere?
Well, we have, and we've always had, for a long time anyway, had quite extreme right-wing groups. Going back to the 1960s and 70s, we had the National Front, mm-hmm. who I think then transmogrified into the British National Party, the BNP. We now have the English National Defence League.
English Defence League.
Yeah. English Defence League, I beg your pardon. But I'd like to think, and I hope I'm not being naive, that these people are a very, very small minority, very much on the edge of British politics. They've never had any parliamentary representation, I'm glad to say. The BNP, the British National Party, have won council seats. They've had representation in Stoke-on-Trent. They've had representation in Burnley in northern Lancashire. So they tend to get representation in areas, particularly with Asian populations, so where there's a white backlash against Asian populations. But they peaked, really, a number of years ago. I think they had about 30 council seats out of several thousand, if not tens of thousands, of council seats in England. So we really are talking about a very, very small number. But, of course, they gain a lot of publicity, and like the experience in Charlottesville, every now and then there are some pretty unsavoury displays of their views in marches. And they're confronted usually by the left. But we don't see these on a regular basis unless maybe I've got my eyes closed to these things.
No, I think you're right. I would endorse everything Bill's just said there. What I think does happen is when, say, the English Defence League do have some kind of public march through a city, the counter-demonstrators turn up in far, far greater numbers. Mm-hmm. So I think Bill's absolutely right. This is a small, a noisy but small, thankfully, faction in British politics.
It brings up an issue that we talked about this morning. In fact, when you all first arrived here at Montpelier, we were talking about James Madison and the First Amendment and the protections in there and how that was very near and dear to Madison's heart. And we were comparing and contrasting the British and American approaches to free speech. Mm-hmm. If you would, let's explore that a little bit more. I was pointing out how broadly the First Amendment protects speech, even so-called hate speech. Mm-hmm. That's why you can have Nazi rallies in Charlottesville and the police will show up and protect the Nazis, as well as anybody else who's there. Tell me about British law in this area. If I wanted to go to Britain and I wanted to hoist my swastika and start spouting off anti-Semitic rhetoric, would there be legal consequences?
Well, the rough equivalent of your First Amendment is not British law necessarily, but the European Convention of Human Rights. And it's Article 10 of the European Convention of Human Rights, and I've actually... being a bit of a law geek, got a copy of it here. So Article 10, Paragraph 1 should be noted. It says everyone has the right to freedom of expression. It goes on. But then Paragraph 2 says the exercise of these freedoms, since it carries with it duties and responsibilities, may be subject to such formalities, conditions, restrictions, or penalties as are prescribed by law and are necessary in a democratic society. In the interest of national security, territorial integrity or public safety, for the prevention or disorder of crime, for the protection of health or morals, for the protection of the reputation or rights of others, and so on. So there's a lot of caveats attached to that. Now, that's the European Convention of Human Rights. Human Rights Act of 1998, an act of the United Kingdom Parliament, formally incorporates the European Convention into UK law and gives the European Convention effectively the force of law in UK courts. So there is a freedom of expression, that's Article 10, Paragraph 1, but lots of restrictions imposed on it by Paragraph 2.
So if I want to go to Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park and I want to wear my jack boots and hoist my swastika, what happens to me?
I think you would be arrested.
What would I be charged with?
Well, I have that as well, if you just bear with me a second here. My personal view is that would be a crime under UK law. That would be the Public Order Act of 1986, Section 5, which is as follows. So this is, as I said, Public Order Act 1986, Section 5. A person is guilty of an offence if he or she uses threatening or abusive words or behaviour or disorderly behaviour or displays any writing, sign or other visible representation which is threatening or abusive within the hearing or sight of a person likely to be caused harassment, alarm, or distress thereby. That is a criminal offence.
Okay, so I'm going to jail.
I would think so, yes.
I think that's one of the biggest distinctions between UK and US constitutional law.
I agree, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Which approach do you think is the wiser?
Well,
I know that's a normative question. I'm just curious. We've been talking about differences. That's a current debate.
That's a difficult question.
Well, I mentioned this morning, I just had a marvelous, taught a seminar with a marvelous woman. Her name is Marianne Franks. In fact, she was just recently on the show. And she, of course, believes in free speech, mm-hmm. but she thinks perhaps some speech should be outlawed because of the terrible effects it has on society.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And she points out that we make other exceptions to our freedom of speech. You can't use your speech to commit a fraud. You can't use your speech to threaten somebody. You can't incite violence. I mean, mm-hmm. you can't reveal state secrets. I mean, there are all sorts of restrictions we already have, mm-hmm. and each of them is problematic in its own way. But her argument is, well, we can see how certain speech harms individuals and groups, mm-hmm. racist speech, misogynistic speech.
Yep.
Shouldn't we make exceptions for them as well? And that's a legitimate question, especially in an era, as we've discussed, where such expressions seem to be much more common and perhaps much more virulent. Mm-hmm. So now we get back to the question. I've given you a chance to think about it now. Which approach do you think is better, the U.S. approach or the U.K. approach?
Well, as I say, it's not the U.K. approach. It's the European approach. So right. I'm a European, so I'm going with the European approach.
You're 91% European.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, although, as Bill was pointing out earlier on, the EU mm-hmm. is one thing. The European Convention of Human Rights, which I've just been quoting from, is something else. But broadly, that is the European approach.
Aren't you afraid, though, of such restrictions, what effect they will have upon political discourse generally? Do you think it will have a chilling effect that people will be afraid to express their honest political views in the
future? Honestly, sorry to interrupt. No. I mean, the European Convention of Human Rights is 60-odd years old now. Mm-hmm. It was set up in the post-war era as a reaction to, Nazi Germany's abuses. And I think it's done a good job, to be honest. And there's zero appetite very little appetite, as far as I'm aware, for the UK to withdraw from the European Convention. So the UK, just to clarify a point for your listeners, the UK is leaving the European Union. Mm-hmm. March 2019, but is not leaving the European Convention of Human Rights. So things like that freedom of expression, which is encapsulated in Article 10 of that convention, that will remain mm-hmm. part of UK law for the foreseeable future, and I think that's a good thing.
Well, as I told Marianne, I'm pretty close to being a First Amendment absolutist. I just have this visceral response anytime someone puts any sort of restriction on my speech. Mm-hmm. But if the concern is political discourse, Marianne makes a good point, and that is that are we really encouraging political discourse when we're allowing one actor to intimidate another one? You know, how much political speech are you going to get from women if they're having all of these misogynistic slurs hurled at them mm-hmm. every single time they dare to express an opinion on the internet? How much speech are you going to have from minorities if they are having racial slurs tossed at them all the time? So maybe her argument is that by restricting some of the most hateful speech, mm-hmm. you're actually encouraging more free speech from the targets of that hateful speech.
Wow. Well, yeah. I can see that point. I don't know if I have a...
Yeah, it's an interesting argument.
Yeah. Actually, if I can just go back to the UK legal position just for a second.
Sure.
Just to emphasize that it's a criminal offense to use threatening or abusive words. So you can say words that are inflammatory, as long as they're not threatening or abusive,
right?
You remain within
we
the
also
law.
Allow the outlawing of true threats, but it's that abusive term that I think would probably get some people in trouble.
Okay. I should actually point out that 4 years ago, that UK law that I've just been quoting there used to be wider. So until 2014, the law would criminalize people who used threatening or abusive or insulting.
So that went too far.
So that seems to have gone. So that was the law for a significant period of time, but the word insulting has been deleted from the statute now.
I'm glad to do that because I think, 90% of political discourse is probably insulting.
Yeah, so it's once more perfectly legal to insult other people in the UK.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for sharing these insights about UK constitutional law and Brexit and all these other fascinating issues, for sharing them with us today.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Stuart.
Very welcome. Thank you.
Hey, we've got just a couple of minutes left. Time enough for a quiz. Constitutional quiz recorded at the We the People State Finals, Virginia, 2018. My quiz gal is Meg Hubeck from the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, being ably assisted by Stephanie Hessian.
So who do we have here?
Rachel Alexander.
And I'm Nicholas Wright.
And you're from which school?
Freeman High School.
Yay, Freeman High School.
And you all had two teams here today. You had Sotomayor and Kagan, named after two Supreme Court justices. Which are you from?
We're from Kagan.
Kagan, okay.
Okay. So what is the chance that an amendment would be passed by Congress? A, 1%, B, 0%, C, 23%, D, 0.23%, or none of the above.
Okay, let me make sure I understand this. We're talking about constitutional amendments.
The percentage that have been passed by Congress.
So comparing the number that have been introduced in Congress to the number that are actually passed by the necessary two-thirds majority of each House of Congress. So we're looking at the percent. Basically, we're looking at your chances. If you're a member of Congress and you introduce a proposed constitutional amendment, statistically speaking, over the course of the last 231 years, almost, how much of a chance do you have to actually get that passed by the just by the Congress?
Yes.
We're not even talking about ratification.
No.
Okay.
And this is what I love about We the People is this collaboration and this critical thinking. Look
Wonderful.
At them working so hard.
Absolutely. Let's listen in on their deliberations
They're
here.
Still talking. They're still
let's listen in on them.
Right? So...
Yeah, we were doing some math here.
Okay.
If the total number of amendments proposed was above 10,000, and we've only got 27.
Right. So which number's the closest to that?
Can you repeat the number?
1%. You can put your hand up when you hear the number you think it is.
Okay.
1%, 0%, 23%, 0.23%, or none of the above?
0%.
It's up to you. It's up to you. You got it, Rachel.
We'll go with 0%.
Go with 0%? You mean there's no chance?
Well, a statistical point, zero.
A statistic.
There's 0% chance.
I'll write it down.
0.3?
Okay.
Think about it now.
We're going to change our answer then.
Okay, what's your answer?
0.23.
Yay! Ding, 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 ding.
I think I understand where you were coming from.
That was good math. That was good mathematical reasoning.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to my good buddy, William Walton, Bill to his friends, from the University of Northumbria, where he teaches American constitutional law. Thanks also to our new friend, Tony Story, who also teaches at the University of Northumbria. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, which originated in England.